Ahoy, Vachon. How's the French say, Vachon? This is the Brown Briefly, where less is more, more or less, coming to you live over KVSH 101.9 FM, Voice of Vachon, your island connection. Please make us part of your day. And be advised that our assertions and views, which can modestly be described as progressive persuasion, do not in any way reflect the opinions of KVSH or Voice of Vachon.
Hi, good morning, Vachon and outer environs. I'm Lynn Kerrigan. I'm the host of this week's Brown Briefly. That was a voice of our founder and colleague, Brian Brown. He's no longer with us, but we do have four other Brieflies beside myself in the comfort of our own homes and in the studios. Our captain of the airwaves, Truman O'Brien. Thank you, Truman. We'll come back around and do some longer introductions, but I'm just saying who's here. We have poet and author and teacher Gail Kellner here, and guardian of the galaxy, historian Bruce Hallman, and activist engineer Kevin Jones. Thank you for joining us today. We look forward to looking at the current affairs and the news, local, state, and national, trying to make sense of it with a little bit of integrity and civility and respect for the facts and for each other. So I hope you enjoy the show. Let's hear how everybody's doing. What was your week like? What particular local news have you been following this week? Truman, can you start?
Well, of course, the windstorm, which took the whole darn island out. I think we lost it about just before 8, if I'm not mistaken, yesterday morning. I don't know about the rest of you guys, but I was out until 9 o'clock last night.
Oh.
And I think most of the island came back late afternoon.
Yeah, mine came on 2:30.
Yeah, yeah. And but boy, we didn't. And in fact, there's some folks over on Bank that still don't have their power. They're still out. So it's just, it's been a real hassle. And by the way, Kevin, you got a haircut, man. You look great.
You know, Susie, she's got her cataract surgery is now behind her. She's got new glasses.
There you go.
She said, you know, before now I was worried about either cutting off my thumb or shearing your ear down to size. And she said, now's the time. And, you know, she cut, I think, every darn one of them. Actually.
Yeah, I think she didn't miss a one. Yeah, it looks great.
It's pretty
great.
Phenomenal work.
So you didn't just get a haircut, you got a hair cut, right?
I got a hair cut, yeah.
Yeah, there you go.
It looks good.
Hey, I do have one thing to throw out. I don't think, I hate to tell you that my brain is so fried. I hadn't talked about the Van Gogh exhibit, did I? Did I talk about that last week?
No, you said you were. You said it was good, I think, just in a note to us, but you didn't talk about
it. Yeah, well, I have to tell you, if you guys get a chance, absolutely do not miss the total immersion event of the Van Gogh exhibit. It is absolutely phenomenal.
Where is it?
It's in the Soto District. It's on Occidental, which is like a couple of streets over from First Avenue. It's in that industrial area. They've taken an old warehouse and put this exhibit in. You go into the exhibit, and the first part of it are some prints of paintings and kind of the history of Van Gogh and his brother and Gauguin and, you know, the people that he associated with. Anyway, it's kind of the story. And then you go into this huge room, and it has these projectors that project on all the walls and the floor, and the music plays, and they've animated his art, and it is... It's just amazing. I mean, really amazing. And then you go from there, if you get the VIP pass, you go into the next room and you put on a VR, you know, the virtual reality goggles, where you have the sound you're sitting in a swivel chair because you have to spin around and look at all around you because it's 360 degrees around you. And you move through and it kind of tells you the story of his, you know, his paintings and, anyway,
wow.
Enough about that, but go
Ray
see
Ray Bradbury see said
it.
This day would come, kind of the days of immersive holographic kind of imagery surrounding us.
It is amazing. Do not Gail? Miss it.
Oh, I just would like to say that I just think it's fantastic. I haven't seen it yet, but I'm planning to go, and I just love to see the community, the larger group, larger numbers of people enjoying something like Van Gogh's work, because it is presented in a way that's more accessible. Yeah. Not everyone wants to go to a museum or spend the time to take the art history classes and look at a still painting on a wall. But when you turn it into something that's experiential and more in line with the movies that we've all right. come to love and enjoy, I think you get that exposure out there. Absolutely. And I'm a big Van Gogh fan. I studied painting in Southern France and toured the place that he lived there in when he was not well, and saw the irises that he actually painted. Irises go on living. They were 150 years old about at that time I saw them, and I'm sure they're blooming there still. So.
Wow. Well, one of the things they talked about his the sunflowers, and they said in one painting he used 32 shades of yellow.
Wow.
In this one painting, which is amazing to me. But anyway.
Yeah, he was beautiful. Bruce and Kevin, tell me, Bruce, you start. What you been up to this weekend? What you been paying attention to here?
Not much. The storm and, of course, the high tide that came with it. KVI Beach was totally underwater yesterday. And so was the road at Portage. So very interesting to see how global climate change has not really increased sea levels dramatically yet. I mean, that's coming. But just the incremental small changes that are occurring. And when you get a big storm like we had and an extreme low pressure and a very high tide, you see some pretty interesting sort of indications of what we'll see over the next 5, 10, 15 years. Tramp Harbor Fishing Dock, the water was right up to the bottom of the cross beams, so
full as it could be.
In another 5-10 years, places like that are going to be underwater. Roads are going to be impassable. So time to start thinking about infrastructure on Vashon.
So are we going to have two islands again? They're going to... to fill
pretty quick
the
if they don't do
come
something
across Portage. Yeah,
that'll take a while, but yes, eventually. Yeah. Maury Island can succeed from Vashon.
Maybe just depends on the time of day, right? Whether you have one island or two.
Well, that's the great story. The interpretation, and it's sort of apocryphal, but the interpretation is that when Vancouver came through and named the island, just one island, Vashon's Island with apostrophe S, in 1792, it was a low tide. So he saw one island. When Wilkes came by, 50 years later, and he saw two islands because it was high tide. So sort of an apocryphal story, but an interesting way to look at Wilkes's attempt to establish American dominance in the Pacific Northwest by naming everything, and he had a chance to name the second island, so he did.
Wow. Well, go ahead, Gail.
Oh, I didn't have anything in particular, but I would just say that certainly we've seen all of the leaves that are nearly all of the leaves off the trees now after this last
all
winter.
At once. Yeah. They're all in my storm drain.
Yeah, I've been watching that, and I don't actually rake my yard because I let them sit there, one because they're wonderful mulch, but also because I love the colors, and I think we finally reached the end of the fall colors after this last storm.
Wow. Well, I was involved in the child vaccine clinic last Wednesday and Thursday at McMurray, doing the 3rd through 5th graders, and we'll be doing the K-2 graders next. They're already sort of staffing that, getting that set up to go, so that will be soon. Then another round of it in a month. So that was intense, but I got to go see David Grisman at the Vashon Center for the Arts, the old mandolin player for the Grateful Dead, and I'll tell you what, talk about precision, fast, incredibly perfect mandolin playing that sounded like the master that he was. It was lovely. It was good. Well, What news have you been following in the state? I was wondering what would happen once Inslee's mask mandates sort of got overruled for some of these other businesses and sort of some of the processes that are happening as people are headed toward this next election. Anything interesting for you guys?
I've just been not so much on the directly to the news in the state with regard to masks, but I have been following Pfizer and Merck with the release to what they call anywhere license for their treatment, their treatments for COVID-19. So I was encouraged by that, to see these very large companies making that available, in Pfizer to 95 countries around the world, Merck to 105. Most all of these are poor countries that couldn't otherwise, most of the people there couldn't afford the treatments.
And these are not the vaccines. They're the
pills
that you take as soon as you recognize you have that virus.
Right. Yeah. I mean, Pfizer did make, I don't know about Merck, Pfizer did make, I read, $36 billion on the vaccine, which is a lot of money. And so I'm happy to see them giving back in at least this way.
Hope so. Goodness. Mm-hmm. Well, I just hope we continue some progress and that we're able to keep our borders open and those kinds of things. I kind of cross my fingers and hope. I think that, I worry about some of the challenges to this. It's healthy in our democracy. I'd rather see us challenge these things in a court of law I'd rather do it in a court of law than have people upset about it. I kind of am interested in how it will come down. I see, Truman, you brought that up. Were you thinking about any questions related to that?
No, I was just, I don't know what the latest is on the mask mandate, and I was just trying to see that. If I know that there was some challenge to it, but I don't see that listed on the website. So.
Well, I mean, one of the difficulties of the American judicial system is that there are appeals, and so, I mean, I always find it interesting how news organizations sort of take off and, there's an appeal court decision or there's an initial decision that's going to be appealed and then the appeals court. And I mean, these things work their way up to the Supreme Court, either state or federal Supreme Court. And so decisions at any one level are kind of just part of the battle, part of this, the legal sort of wrangling that goes on. So it's hard to make much of anything. Unless the legal arguments are just overwhelmingly clear and you get a sense of where the court's going. But for things like this mask mandate, it'll be months before we really know where that's going to be.
Yeah. And let me just state, Truman, I see you have a question too, but for the record, I think what happened, correct me if I'm wrong, you guys, is that there was a court that overruled the mask mandate in this state for businesses, I think with 500 people or whatever it is. And the understanding that I have of it was a jurisdictional question that he overreached, and that this is an OSHA area of protection rather than a governmental open season sort of on, executive privilege to just call it. So it's hard to know, how much of an emergency it is and what emergency powers are necessary and what are routine and valid points that should be discussed, as everybody is asked to be changing.
So one of the questions I have, and this has been bugging me for a long time, and it really doesn't, I mean, it's not directly related to this, but I keep saying, well, they appeal that decision, or it goes to an appellate court. Well, I always understood that the way it would get to be appealed is if they found some error or some problem with the decision, the way it was arrived, rather than, well, we just didn't like the opinion, so we're going to go to our higher court.
Good point.
I don't understand that. I mean, Is that possible, Bruce? Do you know the answer to that?
Well, yeah. I mean, again, the appeal has to be based on something substantive.
Well, yeah, I mean.
But in every decision, there's something substantive that you can appeal. You know, I mean, what Lynn was talking about, this sort of what are the limits to the executive power, not only of the governor, but of the president of the United States? I mean, those are important questions. And so no matter what a court decides, you know, whoever loses that appeal is going to make an appeal to the next higher court because it's a broad issue.
And they're good questions, I think. I think they're reasonably valid questions. Well, on what basis, you know, are you appealing? I think, you know, we talked last week about we hear so much from so many sources and it goes by so fast. We're not really thinking in deep time. You know, we're kind of reacting to things that are bouncing off the walls and we don't know what the end product is.
Right.
And those kinds of things. We're going to appeal, you know, is one of them. They just state the action and not the motive.
Right. Kevin?
Yeah. You know, Truman, interesting question you raise. What's coming to mind for me, and maybe you intended or didn't intend this, is, you know, here's Court A, and they apply one version of the law.
Exactly.
And then it gets appealed to Court B, and they apply some other version of the law. Kind of thing is that, and yeah. I don't know if that's what you had in mind, but
it is certainly.
You know, looking at the thing from our perspective, we hear stories that imply that, as opposed to what I think you're proposing, which makes sense, is were there any irregularities right. in
exactly.
the application
exactly.
of the law in Court A, and if right. so, Court B has an opportunity to correct that process.
Exactly. I think a mistrial sort of is based on those kind of obvious or
errors, yeah.
It's more surface errors than the appeal process. Those are a number of reasons, I guess. Well, I want to, excuse me, Bruce, I'm going to have you finish, but I'm just going to turn the corner a little bit with another part of the program. But go ahead, please.
I mean, you got to remember the law is based in language.
Mm-hmm.
And language is not specific. You know, the words used in drafting legislation have many, you know, is it a this or is it a then, you know, and it can lead to very different interpretations. And ultimately, this comes back to one of the fundamental concepts that we're sort of struggling with in jurisprudence right now, is that concept of originalism. Do we go back to what was originally intended by the legislatures or by the Constitution or by whatever sort of is under discussion, or do we look at the intent? And that's the fundamental split between conservatives and liberals in the judicial world. You know, and so you've got the sort of Scalias of the world who are originalists and want it to be only what was originally intended. And then you've got others like the Ginsburg schools who are saying, well, it's really what was intended. And that's at the basis of much of the legal struggle that's going on in the United States and has been going on for a long time.
You know, I'm going to move us because that's actually a great segue to something that I want to kind of experiment with, and that's sort of the idea of the flash panel, which means, you know, everybody respond to these questions that I'm going to give you, which come from an insert that was in the New York Times last Sunday, and it was called Snap Out of It, America, which I thought was interesting. When I looked at it, they talked about we have gotten so trapped in our polarities in politics, and we've gotten so stuck in our kind of trying to conserve and protect what we have and kind of share what we have, that we're not thinking with a wide open political imagination now. And so they decided they would propose several questions, some of them in a survey form, which I think are pretty interesting, that I'm going to pose to the panel, and I'm going to pose them quickly so that I'll have you kind of yay or nay, or think, well, who does that benefit? Or is that ever viable? You know, sort of a brief response to these so we can work our way through. And then and there's another probably seven other big ideas for change that were in there. And Bruce, they kind of get to some of the fundamental concepts behind and within some of these principles. I think it's really interesting. So Truman is telling me that I'm getting so passionate I'm loud. But seven ideas for some new amendments to the Constitution. I'm going to take their big things first and see what you have to say to this. Their idea is just that these are actual legal scholars and political writers who have made the paragraphs, actually, to amend the language in the, you know, Constitution and the amendments. So one is, all workers have the right to form and join labor unions.
Yay.
Well, I kind of,
absolutely.
I kind of thought we already had that. I mean,
that's what I thought too, yeah.
I mean, where is it not allowed? I mean, you have
the,
to get
the right to work states.
There you go.
Oh, that's true. You're right.
Kind of a misnomer, because what that really means is that you can work without being in a union, which don't have to let you unionize.
Right.
And
you're right.
Benefits the left, I think. So I'm all for it. Benefits, you know, the people, the essential workers that we've had to rely on recently. Any other thoughts about it? Is it viable, do you think?
I don't know why not.
Absolutely.
We've had unions, and they have actually been the underpinnings of the middle class for a long time. And when they have lost power, as they have in, you know, the last 20, 30, 40 years,
I'll just say one quick thing. I was a union member for 20 plus years, and I was never a big fan of unions, but when the union and management work together to make the system work, it works very well. And the union represents, in my case anyway, safety and taking care of the health of the worker. And as long as the company works with that union, it's a really collaborative
program.
It's a very good
better
thing.
Better than adversarial.
When it's adversarial, it does not work.
Yeah. And I worked for Group Health for a long time, and they had the same sort of process that avoided a lot of the conflictual things. I liked it.
Kevin?
Yeah, I was part of the largest white-collar union in the country, and it's kind of a long story about how I ended up becoming part of that union. But it was also the largest white-collar strike in the country that caused the shop to become a closed shop, I think is the right terminology. So you had to become a member of the union if you were working in that for that company. And as a consequence of that, the benefits of union membership and the service to the union members from that particular union was pretty eye-opening in terms of the benefits. And some of the issues that came up that they had to address were really very equity oriented, you know, really valuable to, you know, raise the issues, open the eyes about how workers were treated and how to improve everybody's experience working for the company. So, you know, they can be a very positive, beneficial force. So I'm all for it.
Me too. So next question would be a modification to the 13th Amendment. It would strike the clause that says that there can be financial punishments, parts of punishments that basically create an involuntary servitude clause, kind of free prison labor. We're starting to hear about that. Should people be paid minimum wage, you know, when they're working in detention centers, even the immigrants? So what do you think about that, to strike the clause that says people can work for free or almost nothing, and we benefit from that?
Well, one thing I know about that is that many people who come out of prison are left with huge debts because they're actually charged for the time that they're in prison. And if they may be working for virtually no money at all and yet be charged money. So I think that they should at least be able to earn the wages to pay for their own debts that they're incurring. I don't think most people know that people come out of prison with bills.
Yeah.
And furthermore, right, they have to dispose of those financial obligations before they can be restored full citizenship rights, like voting. Yeah. And of course, only in certain states does that happen automatically. And even in some states where it happens automatically, apparently they're not required to be informed that they have, you know, those rights have now been restored. So legal financial obligations, yeah. I believe LFOs is the terminology for that. At the Northwest Detention Center, that issue was raised, and the folks who were detained there were paid very minimal amounts, and as you say, Lynn, they were charged pretty high rates for simple things that went beyond their normal diet, for example, that was provided by the detention center team. And so the good news is that that was improved. I don't know to the extent that they earn minimum wage, but it's definitely an issue, and it's an issue close to home.
Exactly. This opinion and this proposal was written by Deborah Archer, a professor at NYU School of Law and the president of the ACLU, the American Civil Liberties Union. And it just strikes the clause in the 13th Amendment that says, except as punishment for a crime whereof the party shall have been duly convicted, neither slavery nor involuntary servitude will exist.
I think that's especially important, Lynn. I'll let you move on, but it's especially important when we have for-profit prisons, where these systems are set up to make a profit. And I think that's, somewhere I'd like to rewrite that issue.
Well, important also to contextualize that. I mean, that was written at a time right after the Civil War when every state had prisons and chain gangs and people working. Prison labor was viewed as free labor. By the states and by the federal government, and things have changed. And so how do we modify, the Constitution? How do we modify the amendments to the Constitution to reflect the new world we live in?
Yeah, it's interesting. So, I thought this would kind of reflect, Bruce, what you were saying is that all of these are living fluid language concepts, that we all have different experiences of.
Unless you're an originalist.
Yeah. And in which case, just stop it. And this one was written by Alexandra DeSantis, a staff writer at National Review and a fellow at the Ethics and Public Policy Center. It's another idea for a 28th Amendment. The word person shall apply to all human life, born and unborn, and would possess rights. It's fleshed out here.
But understand the reasoning behind that is not about people. It's that corporations can no longer be defined as persons. Right now, a corporation is defined as a person and has the same rights as an individual. And that's why we have untrammeled capitalism right now. Mm-hmm.
I would just love to see... I would absolutely love to see that change so that the rights had to be granted to humans. I don't know about the part that says born or unborn, because I think that gets into the tricky issue of the life that, of abortion rights and rights to choice for women.
Well, yeah, that's one of the things that I read it as, Gail, was more question about abortion and giving, quote, explicitly recognizing fetal personhood. I would love it if they would use it to overturn Citizens United, but I'm not sure I read the amendment as that way. It would be good if it would. Shows you that importance of the precision of language.
This is talking about the precision in language. Citizens United is another misnomer. Like, it's really about giving corporations personhood, and yet it's passed off as Citizens United, which is just absolutely ridiculous in my view. As is the right to work laws, these ideas, they call them as if someone's stopping you from working. No, join a union so that you can work under fair and with fair wages and working conditions.
Yeah, sometimes it is, as you say, deceptive phraseology. They make it sound like it's coming from public service and good-hearted people when it's corporate protection sometimes. Let the buyer beware, caveat emptor. I'm going to move us along.
Well, in fact, I did want to comment on Gail's observation. It's become an art form, not only the messaging that you're citing and how we name things, but it's also an art form in terms of legislative engagement, where one party will introduce a piece of legislation to achieve a certain outcome, and the opposing party will introduce a piece of legislation which sounds almost exactly like the legislation of the other party, but it has some loopholes or some off-ramps or some other conditions that don't allow the full potential of the former legislation to be to fulfill the goals, you know, the idea. And so it's very challenging to be able to work in that area in terms of advocacy, to let people know that, yeah, that thing that sounds really good is actually the bad bill, and this bill that sounds almost identical is actually the good bill, and keep that straight in your head.
Oh my gosh.
So it's definitely an art form, and something that people do need to be aware of does happen on a regular basis.
I'll get right to you, Gail. I was just going to say it reminds me of something I read that George Washington said, which is that the truth is so important, it must come with a bodyguard of lies. I don't quite know what it means, but I like it.
I was just going to say, I think we need to call it something besides an art form, though I totally understand what you're saying, Kevin, but only because I revere art and I think of this as a form of deception. So
that makes
it's a Machiavellian plot. How about that?
Proper way. Yeah, we need to think about how to do that.
Just a Machiavellian plot.
Well, especially because we're talking about language. Right. Thanks for letting me throw that in, Kevin.
This one I thought was interesting. This is the fourth suggestion of the seven, so I'm going to move us along a little bit. That international law should be part of American law. Apparently, Germany sort of said they should all be contingent or part of each other. You know, the human rights that were passed, especially through the UN in 1948. You know, respecting everyone's right to life and dignity and all that. And they talking here about we have violated a lot of international law overseas. Any thoughts?
Well, much of the world uses the United Nations Declarations of Rights and Responsibilities, which is the 1948 law, that international law that you're referring to there, Lynn. Mm-hmm. It is the basis of law, of quite a bit of international law, as well as new countries as they form their constitutions over the last, 75 years have looked at that as a basis for their constitutions. And of course, the United States did sign that declaration. So, however, it's interesting, international law is not always, international law really refers, generally speaking, to laws that affect national issues between nations, not so much within nations. So I would love to see it, because I am a big promoter of that particular document that Eleanor Roosevelt, by the way, was so deeply involved in. So,
thank you. Anybody else? I'm going to move us to the next one, which has been discussed a lot nationally recently, and I'm eager to hear what you think. This idea that the Supreme Court should be expanded and its powers limited. And the body of this was written by Barry McDonald, a law professor at Pepperdine University, who says maybe we'll have 16 justices with a seat added to the court every 2 years until that number is reached, allocated geographically in a uniform manner across the states.
Mm.
16. So do you think that would benefit any, of the partisan worries that we have now?
Well, again, historically, the Supreme Court has not always had 9 members. It's varied from 5 to 12. So 9 is not a magic number by any means. It's really what you want the court to be. And do you want it to be a co-equal branch of government? And limiting the power of the Supreme Court, which is the second part of that, I think, sort of strays into an uncomfortable area where if you don't have the court as a check on the legislature and the executive, who do you have to check it? Particularly if one party can dominate both houses of Congress and the White House, then there's no check on the power of a political party. So my sense is it's important to have the Supreme Court be a co-equal member of government, of the three branches of government, and have the power to basically check the other two branches.
Yeah,
I agree. And I think there's one issue, though, that by having fewer members and having one party being able to seat members on that, I think it does become more politicized. And perhaps by expanding the number, you tend to move away from that, would be my thought. I don't know if that's a true statement or not, but it seems to me that that makes more sense.
Two relevant things as I read the body of this. One is that they're proposing term limits. That's part of what they mean by limiting power. So they're not necessarily on there for life. And they're also talking about to make big decisions, like what laws to get rid of. They're talking about requiring a supermajority of a 16-member panel would both allow for alliances and make it harder to knock out, you know, important pieces of legislation, which to me just sounds like, if you read between the line, we're talking about Roe versus Wade right there. You know, that something that is so divided in the country, or maybe kind of slightly one way or the other, but, you know, fairly equally in terms of, you know, intent right there. Lots of questions about that. So to me, that's very relevant in that people are thinking about actually doing that right now to maintain some of our important laws. I don't know if they'll succeed, but I think it's in the air. Up for one or two more?
Sure.
No city or state should restrict people's free movement. They are saying that both state and city laws of local zoning, housing and land use, and interstate trade laws really can redline people out of certain neighborhoods and kind of make it easier to determine who lives where. What do you think?
Yeah. It's a little bit of a mixed bag. I know some people would really like to see some of those restrictions lifted, because people who would like to, for example, form small community farms, for example, have a difficult time doing so because it doesn't allow for multiple housing on a farm. So that's one of the ones I've run into just in my travels, or particularly in the Northwest and farming communities. This desire to be able to have some concentrated housing outside of cities.
Yeah.
However, I don't want a strip mall up and down any road anywhere.
So that's kind of where I was going with that. I would be concerned about industrial, you know, if you don't have any, if you can't have this local zoning or free movement, what is it going to take about if you have a big corporation move in that's, you know, dirty and whatever, you want that in the middle of your community? I don't think so. So I don't quite understand
one of the points, because you're right, you know, I've given you very little data, you know, it's almost absurd. But this is talking about low population mobility, which makes economic redistribution and sort of just housing areas less effective. I think that poor people are less likely to be in the same states and cities as rich taxpayers, or in real different kinds of neighborhoods. So I think it's just an idealistic idea of how you spread the housing out so it's not quite so restricted. I don't know. You know, but on the other hand, this is not necessarily everybody's feedback. You know, these are big ideas, and some of them, like you're maybe thinking, you know, require a lot more thought or information or implications of what's happening. I like it that people are kind of thinking about all of this. You know, a little bit easier one that was really been in the news, the seventh idea, is the right to privacy from search and seizure should also include not just our, you know, our homes and our persons, but our data and our metadata, you know, the information about us that's being sold and open to everybody all over the world. What do you think about that? How's that going to happen?
I absolutely agree with that one.
It's going to be tough, though. That's the only thing I'm thinking. But having recently been hacked, I'm all for the privacy that you can guarantee.
Yeah. Yeah, exactly. It's kind of scary. Mm-hmm. Well, they had a lot of other ideas. I'm going to throw a bunch of them out here, and if there's anything that stick to your cabinets, that's the way I test my spaghetti. Is it done? I just throw it up against my cabinets. You know, let's do whatever we want. So one real interesting thing is they suggested that we probably have six factions of political parties, and they ask you to think about which one you felt most aligned with. I thought that's kind of interesting. There are other big ideas, just so you know, were to enlist the young and have compulsory national service, forgive all crushing debt, mortgage and student loans, that people are just buried in debt in America. Joe, let children vote was one of my favorite ones.
You're hitting a bunch of my hot buttons here. Yeah,
you know, we have these advisory votes on the Washington ballot, and they don't, you know, they're taken under advisement, presumably, right? The legislature in many cases has already acted, and I don't know how often they go back and revise, you know, previous decisions. But the idea that there can be an advisory vote from every person in the country that is, like, you know, a week or so before the actual election, and they send
a survey almost. Yeah,
and I don't know. Would that be like inappropriate bias? Like, you know, you're not supposed to release any information about the poll, you know, the polling data until after the polls close. And so maybe it would be restricted to people who don't actually have an opportunity to vote. And I can see pitfalls. I can see advantages. interesting idea to kick around.
Well, it's all about that. It's all about just having an imagination, I think, about what kind of things are we stuck? What kind of things start making some sense? That whole idea in here about we need new states. Should we carve up some existing states or start adding territory? Gail, what are you thinking?
Well, I certainly would like to see our existing territories have voting status, and how we manage to have, you know, in the United States, to have districts and areas that we control, but they don't have the right to vote, and they certainly pay taxes. So I don't know how in the United States that happens. And although I heard Truman grumble, I actually like the idea of forgiving some debt, crushing debts. There's something, you know, in the Jewish tradition called the Jubilee year, and which I think it's approximately every 50 years or so, all debt is forgiven. And this has been true in other communities, Native communities as well. It's a similar to a potlatch.
I agree. Now I'm going to hold you up. Truman says we have one more minute, but I thought we had two.
We actually have 30 seconds.
So. No, don't we have till 46?
Oh, yes. Yes.
All right, so here's their ideas for these parties.
Yeah, you're right.
Listen to this. The Progressive Party, these are the left-leaning ones, the Equity and Racial Justice. The New Liberal Party, the professional class establishment that are a little more pro-business and see the wealthy as innovators. The American Labor Party, which is economic populism. Those were the three leftists, and the three right ones were the Growth and Opportunity Party, the socially moderate pro-business, the Patriot Party of Donald Trump, and the Christian Conservative Party. What would you align with? I'm all about American labor.
I'm a progressive through and through. Though I do take exception to the idea that anyone gets to call their party the Patriot Party, because I think being a liberal may be that. And I think being a Christian may align very closely with some of the Labor Party platform and progressive platforms. So just saying.
Well, there's that messaging again.
Yeah, the whole thing is just kind of a game. Take the cornflakes box and shake it up and see what that does to our stuck on, you know.
Okay, guys.
Fixed traditions.
See you all next week. We're done.
Bruce is our host. Join us next week.
All right. Thank you. Thanks for playing.